This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
Well, we're here. That's a fine thing. United Airlines had some sort of a screw-up yesterday. I showed up at Washington, D.C. Seat? You want a seat? Well, I thought I had a seat on this plane. They finally got me on the plane, and then they got me to San Francisco, and then it was, oh, you want to go to Portland? Huh? Well, the plane is leaving at midnight. So, anyhow, I got home at 3 o'clock in the morning, so... We're doing the show today on about 2.5 hours of sleep, and it should be a fine show. Tom Hartman here with you, and so pleased to be with you. I'm so pleased to be back here in our home studio at KPOJ in Portland, Oregon. The Reverend Welton Gaddy is with us, a Southern Baptist minister, the head of the host of State of Belief on Air America Radio, and heads the national nonpartisan grassroots and educational organization, the Interfaith Alliance and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation. Reverend Gaddy, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be with you again.
Great to have you here again.
We've used this studio while you were gone, and thank you for that.
You're welcome. In fact, I think you're going to be using it today, aren't you?
That's right.
It's marvelous. Just be careful. There's one little wire here. Somebody's been messing with this thing. We had a buzz alert before we started. In any case, the issue of faith in the elections is one that... I think it's really, really, really very problematic. As a Christian, I'm concerned about the fact that my own religion has been hijacked by right-wingers and wackos. It's like the Taliban has taken over Christianity. As an American citizen, I'm concerned. Jefferson and Madison had this debate that went on for the better part of 15 years. You read their letters. Jefferson was convinced that if religious people took power in Washington, D.C., that it would lead to theocracy. Madison thought that was a joke, said that was the American people would never tolerate that, particularly after the experience of Massachusetts, and that he thought that the real risk and why his first veto as president was to veto a bill giving money to a church in Washington, D.C. to care for the poor. He said this should be a secular function. His real worry was that because he being a Christian was and Jefferson being a deist was that if government gave money to religion, that religion would become corrupted. Mm-hmm. And looking back on it, it seems to me that both have happened. We have people making policy decisions, secular policy decisions in a secular government based on religion. And we have religions that are raking in the dough and using that money to influence and exploit the political process.
If you listen to the major voices on radio and television right now, you have to almost have a program to know which are supposedly the religious voices and which are the political voices. Yeah. I know you've been traveling abroad. I was abroad some time back, and I thought it was interesting to do. I asked a group of international leaders, business leaders, to name for me the three most prominent religious leaders in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They named one, George Bush. Secondly, Jerry Falwell, who was alive at the time, and then Pat Robertson. But George W. Bush was the number one religious leader. When that's true, and it could have been Bill Clinton, it could have been anybody else that they could have said as president of the United States, when the president of the United States is viewed as the nation's chief religious leader, we have a problem.
Well, we have a theocracy.
Yes.
I mean, that's one of the probably softer definitions of theocracy, but that's what you have. And we've had a number of very, very religious people in office. Probably Jimmy Carter is the most mm-hmm. obvious. He's a member of your church, Southern mm-hmm. Baptist Church. And John Kennedy, for that matter, you know, who famously said that he was running for president of the United States as an American, not as a Catholic. And they have always been able to separate, you know, to paraphrase, was it Jefferson or Madison's letter, separate,
Jefferson.
You know, yeah, mm-hmm. they create the wall of separation between church and state to separate the two, but not now. Not now. We have over $1 billion given in the last election cycle by our tax dollars, the federal government, to churches and religious organizations to do things that were previously done by the government or simply previously not done at all. And that money is paying out very, very good dividends for the Republican Party, or it has been over the last 5-6 years.
Well, it was interesting.
What is the future of that?
It was interesting, Tom, if you followed the trail of when the money was given and where it was given, there were astounding numbers of occasions when the so-called faith-based initiative money was given with big fanfare in a district in which a Republican member of Congress was in trouble.
Right, right. Yeah.
And David Kuo, of course, as you know, pointed the finger. I heard David first make his critique of the faith-based initiative in a congressional hearing in which both of us were testifying against that particular program, and the office was, as was predicted up front, was politicized.
Well, not only that, my recollection is that the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives was not created by Congress. It was not created by law.
Never has
been. It was created by federal fiat, by executive fiat, by the President of the United States. And arguably, you know, my read of the Constitution is that Congress makes the laws, Congress creates the institutions, and the President is charged with enforcing the laws. How did this happen?
Well, it happened, as you said, pragmatically, it happened by the executive order. The hearing, the congressional hearing I just mentioned that David and I were testifying in, was called by a Republican leader in the House who said, this is the only way we have of getting control of what's happening in the faith-based office is to do some legislation that gets us in the picture. Right now, there is no control on how the president and his cabinet uses this money.
Right, right. It's just like with the federal judges, just like, I mean, it would go on right on down the list that everything is being used to create what Carl referred to as the 100-year Republican majority. And, you know, 100 years of single-party rule, Hitler was a little more ambitious. He wanted to have 1,000 years of single-party rule, 1,000 years of peace. But the Politburo, single-party rule, I mean, we've seen this movie before, and it's certainly not Americanism.
And, Tom, you know, I know the listeners to your good show, many of these people have problems even comprehending how an individual could think that he or she is so absolutely right about everything, mm-hmm. that whatever he or she says should become law, should become public policy.
Right.
But that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a classic Christian fundamentalism in the highest offices of the land.
Well, it's not even a Christian fundamentalism. It is a fundamentalism, I would argue, because in my opinion, the essence of Christianity, and I mean, you're the guy who does this for a living, but in my opinion, the essence of Christianity is found in, you know, Matthew 5 through 8 in the Sermon on the Mount, and in Matthew 25, the parable of the goats and the sheep, where Jesus very explicitly was advocating for the poor and saying, you know, the work that we have to do in this world is caring for those. You know, he was basically saying that we are all here to help as community. And that's the traditional liberal view on which this country was founded, whereas the conservative view is, I got mine, screw you.
Yeah.
You know, it's
well, the reason I use that term, Christian fundamentalism, is I grew up in a Christian fundamentalist house. And, in fact, I should say, both for their benefit and for mine, I am no longer a Southern Baptist. I don't know who's happier about that, the people I left or myself, but it yeah. pleases both of us. But I never heard the Matthew 25 passage as a child growing up, about the sheep and the goats, because it didn't fit the ideological program of fundamentalism. That was called social stuff.
But what's so amazing is that's the only place in the entire Bible where the disciples come to Jesus and say, how do we get into heaven?
That's right.
And he says,
But it was the wrong answer for fundamentalists. The answer for fundamentalists was a doctrinaire confession, not social service and compassionate ministry.
Well, to some extent, I suppose you could track this back to the split between the Jerusalem Church and the Pauline Church in the first 100 years after Jesus. But that's a whole other topic, and one that, you know, Elaine Pagels and Peter Funk and others have done such a brilliant job with.
Yeah.
So we just have a few seconds left. We've got a bunch of politicians out there. I'm curious about your take on the Democratic politicians. Do you expect to see religious demagoguery here?
I do. But here's the problem. We have somehow conjured up the idea that the correction to an abuse of religion in the Republican Party is an abuse of religion in the Democratic Party. It will work no better for Democrats than it has worked for Republicans. We are not electing the holy person of the year.
Right.
We're electing the CEO of the president of the president of the United States.
Right.
And we better vote for a good president, not for a national pastor.
Right. Not, a national pastor, a pope, or whatever imam, whatever it may be.
Right.
The Reverend Welton Gaddy, interfaithalliance.org, the website. Thanks so much for being with us.
Glad to be here, Tom.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Why me, George? What have I ever done to deserve even one of the plagues that you've sown? Tell me, George.
In my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in,
to bring chaos,
to kind of catapult the propaganda.
Lord, help me, Jesus. We didn't vote for him, but we can't ignore him, I fear. He's using your name to advance his own game. Now we're in doo-doo,
way up to here we're in doo-doo. Yes, indeed. George, what did you do? What'd you do? You know, the essence of morality, the issue of morality, I think is a really, really vital one, and it's going to be flogged throughout this campaign because the Republicans think it has worked so well for them. Going back to Bill Clinton and his dalliance with Monica Lewinsky, that was a point at which the Republicans said that they were about morality. Although you could say really it goes back to Roe v. Wade and just a whole variety of issues, not just abortion, but a whole variety of issues that had to do with, you know, oh my God, those hippies are doing what? You know, free love? They're smoking pot on street corners? I mean, things like that and this whole issue. But when you really boil it down, there is a conservative worldview of morality and a liberal worldview of morality, and I think it's important to note the two. Because liberals view people as essentially evil and destructive, and therefore the force of government must be used to constrain them, and therefore the only legitimate reason for government to exist is to have police, prisons, and armies. This being the, and that's why the conservatives keep trying to privatize Social Security and keep trying to do away with public education and you know, did away with public funding of college education and try to get the government out of things like, you know, helping people, poor people have housing and food stamps and all these other, a minimum wage? The government shouldn't interfere with the free market. In fact, we're going to be debating that in the next hour. Because they have that worldview, the moral side of the worldview for conservatives is that because people are so nasty, you have to keep an eye on them. So it's entirely appropriate in the conservative worldview that Alberto Gonzalez be listening in on your bedroom, be listening in on your telephone conversations, that, you know, be peeking over the hedges to see what's going on inside your house. Because heaven only knows, you might be smoking something wrong there. You might be having sex in the wrong position or with the wrong person. This is the conservative worldview. The liberal worldview, on the other hand, first articulated in a big way, frankly, by most of the religious leaders of the world, from Buddha to Krishna to Moses to Jesus, the liberal worldview and other Muhammad to a large extent, the liberal worldview is We are a community. We are here together. Humans are essentially good. And the goal of government, the reason we pull government together, of course we want to protect us from the crazies among us, the occasional sociopaths. But the main goal of government is to backstop us. It's to help every individual achieve their highest potential. Not to give people, it's not to pass out welfare. Oh, here, have some money. No. The reason why we pay for education is because there's a return to society on it. I mean, you can look at it in a purely selfish way, but it's also because it helps people achieve their highest potential, and that's the highest goal of government. And that is the essence of morality, and frankly, I think it's the essence of moral religion. And Democrats need to be framing that as a moral issue, not as a religious issue. Morality doesn't necessarily come out of religion. And frankly, morality preceded, absolutely, morality preceded any of the modern religions. I mean, none of them are more than 7,000 years old. And although Hinduism claims that some on various days of the week to be tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of years old, but nonetheless, in their modern form, all of the modern religions were predated by Stone Age people, tribal, aboriginal, indigenous people. And they're still around. You know, in 1800, they represented 50% of the world's population. They're down to 5, 10, 15% now. We've wiped them out by and large part. But that essence of morality is very real. And I think it's a vital one. And then you hear right-wingers, Laura Bush, trying to talk moral.
We welcome to our country more refugees than all the rest of the nations combined. And obviously, we're especially concerned about the Iraqi refugees, people who are there, who are trying to build their government, trying to build a stable country, which is what our goal is as well, who have left because of terror, really, because of the chance of violence and the fear of violence.
No, because of our bombing.
We will welcome many of those refugees, both from Iraq and Afghanistan, into the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, last year we welcomed 500 of them, and this year 69 so far. And yet Iraq is the second largest failed state, according to the United Nations, the second largest failed state in the world. There's over 2 million internal refugees in Iraq, and 2 million people have fled. This enormous brain drain in Iraq. I mean, it's a disaster of biblical proportions going on. And the First Lady... Well, I'll give her the benefit of the doubt. I'm just assuming she has her facts wrong, that she doesn't realize how toxic the administration of her husband is. Let's just give her the benefit of the doubt. Yeah, right. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The way that you want to live, I just have to remember there'll be days like this. And no one steps on my dreams, there'll be days like this. When people understand what I mean, there'll be days like this.
Well, you get good ones and you get bad ones, but by and large, we make our days. You know, I'm not wanting to sound too much like a libertarian here, but we really do. I mean, you have a lot of control over it. It's amazing the studies that they've done where they found that serotonin is the feel-good neurochemical in the body. And if you simply lift the corners of your mouth, even if it's a phony smile, if you lift the corners of your mouth and hold them that way for a minute or two, your serotonin levels go up. And so, you know, famous psychologist years and years ago, and back in the late part of the 19th century, made the comment that all you have to do if you want to make it a better day is stand up straight, pull your shoulders back, take a deep breath, and go for a walk. And then get politically active. I'm looking at our blog over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. And Jeffinator1 says, the president swears... Excuse me. I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and do to the best of my ability preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. That's right out of the Constitution. That's what the President has to say. And Jeffinator says, if Bush is creating law, isn't that an impeachable offense? Can you get any more unconstitutional? acting extra-constitutionally and therefore violating the oath of office of the president was exactly what Andrew Johnson was impeached for, wasn't it? Well, sort of. Actually, Andrew Johnson was impeached in large part, I think, because he was a Democrat. Abraham Lincoln was creating kind of a fusion ticket. He was trying to reach across the aisle. He had a Democrat as a vice president when Lincoln was assassinated. He had all these Republicans in power, and they were stuck with this Democratic president, and they were not pleased. And I think that the assassination of Johnson was, excuse me, impeachment of Johnson was more politically motivated than anything. But anyhow, today, at toward the end of the day, David Poole, our producer, in his totally whimsical way, is going to pick his favorite comment of the day from our airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page blog. Could be serious, funny, whatever. And that person will receive an autographed copy of my newest book, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. So blog with us over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page and check it out. Also, you can drop into our live chat room if you go to airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. There's a link up at the very top. Let me just make sure. It's there. There's a link up at the top that'll take you to our chat room. And also, you can find that over at tomhartman.com. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone numbers, our telephone number. And, of course, as I said, you can drop by our live chat room as well. Tim in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
I was trying to tell my dad about certain things about what Bush is doing because he's so, I don't want to say he's blind, but he's just kind of, well, he tells me I don't have a right to my facts. But he didn't realize that the faith-based initiative allows organizations that are receiving federal funds to discriminate. Basically,
yes.
they can refuse not to hire somebody that's not of the faith, even if they have training and a degree in that particular area. They can refuse.
That's right. And the courts have held that. Which
yes.
is so bizarre that the courts have agreed with that doctrine in something that Congress never passed.
Exactly. So I'm out of a job. I'm in gerontology, and I'm not out of a job. But if I apply at certain places that administer Area Agency on Aging Services, through which is mandated by the government, they can refuse to hire me, even though I'm totally qualified to do the job.
Yeah. Yeah, it is totally bizarre. Things have gone so off the rail. Tim, thanks for pointing that out. Things have gone so off the rail here in the United States that we need a thorough house cleaning from top to bottom. Not just a new Congress, not just a new Senate. We're moving, we're incrementing, moving slowly in that direction. A new president as well. And it's not going to happen if we just vote. It's going to happen if we all get active. And there's not that much time left. 578 days, 12 hours, 16 minutes, and 17 seconds, according to my backwards Bush clock here, that Bush is still in office voluntarily. This clock given to me by Tom Dwyer of Tom Dwyer Automotive here in Portland, who has my car at this very moment, doing a fine job and chastising Louise for our not bringing it in quarterly. You're supposed to bring your car in more often. We want to take good care of it. You're right, Tom. You're right. And we appreciate the great work you do. Adam in Hoboken, New Jersey. Hey, Adam, what's on your mind?
Tom, I saw Laura Bush on TV last night. She was in the AFI's 10 top movies of all time. She wants to stay on the plantation on Terra. And Clark Gable said, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. And I thought that was sort of newsworthy because of all the stuff that's going on. You talk about classism and whatnot. People in federal prison probably get better health care than the average person on the street. And I was thinking that Americans, people that are the working poor, get treated like immigrants, you know. And I was, it's like, well, if Americans are being treated like immigrants, there's something real wrong about, you know, unionizing places that need to offer health care and a living wage, not just a working wage.
Yeah, no, you spot on, Adam, and it's a shame. It's a crisis, and there was a time in this country when we actually viewed it as a shame, where we felt ashamed about it, and we did something about it. Lyndon Johnson cut poverty in the United States in half in just 4 years, and the consequence of that, the consequence of Lyndon Johnson's actions, is that people who prior to that were absolutely stuck in a system where they could not rise. People like Condoleezza Rice, who comes right out and says that her position at Princeton was a consequence of affirmative action. People like Clarence Thomas, people like Colin Powell, who is still an advocate of affirmative action programs, had an opportunity to have their own brilliance, their own competence, actually be recognized in a society that was aggressively not recognizing it as a consequence of the actions of Presidents Kennedy and Johnson and some who followed. And there was a time in the United States when we thought that having poverty in the United States was a national humiliation, a national embarrassment, a national shame. Now we define the greatness of our country not by the quality of the lives of the majority of our people, but by the quality of the lives of our CEOs and our multimillionaires and our billionaires. It's all about the lifestyles of the rich and famous. It's all about Paris Hilton. It's all about all, you know, and all the more the tragedy. We need a profound and deep recalibration in this country. And that, frankly, in my mind, is at the core of not just religion. In fact, I would even say not so much religion, because religion is the institution. Spirituality is really, where I'm at. But of morality. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie.
Hey, Tom. You were talking about religion before, especially with the Reverend Gaddy, is his name?
Yes.
Yes, I've heard his program. It's very good. I think Dems must walk a fine line when discussing their faith, particularly liberal Democrats, because usually when questions are posed to them in mass media, it's within a conservative evangelical context, because the people in mainstream mass media are unconsciously trained to ask questions that way. So,
in fact, Bonnie, if I may interrupt you for just a second, as Reverend Gaddy was leaving the room after we were off the air, I'm pretty sure this is after we were off the air, he said, "Did you hear the questions that were asked?" David's nodding. Yeah, having had only three hours sleep last night, he said, "Did you hear the questions that were asked of the candidates?" He's by CNN. And I was like, no. And he says, they asked Hillary, "What do you pray for the most?" They asked John Edwards, "What's your greatest sin?" He said, "This is nuts. A news organization is asking candidates about, you know, religious questions. This is wrong." And this from, you know, one of America's most famous ministers, a pastor.
Well, so, I don't think they really know any better. It would require them to actually think for themselves or do a little investigating to find out how to reframe those questions to be more inclusive. So when a liberal is asked, he or she must both address the question briefly and then reframe it to be more inclusive, maybe make it more ethical-based, more moral-based. But if you don't address the question, then you see the religious discussion, which in most people's mind is moral to the cause. And moreover, we have a lot of relational voters out there. They're not necessarily voting about issues, and they like to hear a narrative about our formative years. And for many folks, that includes their religious training.
Sure. And you know who's particularly good at that, Bonnie, is John Edwards. John, when they ask him a question about religion or faith or whatever, he'll give a quick answer. Yes, I'm a religious guy. I have faith. And the essence of morality, the essence of religion is, are we caring for all of us? And when we have a country where we have 20-some-odd million people who literally don't know where their next meal is going to come from, 45 million people who don't have health care, so much of this country in poverty, we cannot call ourselves religious, moral, or anything else close to that until we do something about it. Rachel in Los Angeles, just about a minute before we have to take a break. Rachel, what's up?
Oh, okay. Hey, thanks, Tom. Tom, I really think the underlying rationale of all of these conservatives, I mean, they have their different fairy tale reasons that they state, but their actually underlying rationale is creating and maintaining an aristocracy. You know, a few very wealthy and everybody else basically cheap labor.
And there's a reason for that, Rachel, and that's because they think that's the best thing for America. They're really doing it with a good heart. They think that an aristocracy is the most stable form of government. That's what Alexander Hamilton said at the first day of the opening
of the
Constitutional Convention.
But it's really important to point that out, I think, you know, to them and say, okay, but you understand that your rationale will result in an aristocracy.
Yeah, and already has to a large extent. We have an aristocracy now of the very wealthy. We have the aristocracy of the Republican Party. We have, you know, Karl Rove's attempt to have 100 years of single-party rule, which, you know, has been done before. It's been called the Politburo. Didn't last 100 years, but that's what it was all about, single-party rule, the Soviet state. That's Karl Rove's vision of it. And, yes, they're right. It is very stable. It's not American, however. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Diego. We are patriots. We love our country. And that's why we're working so hard to take this country back and return America to the core values on which she was founded. And I just find it so amazing when I hear right-wingers say, oh, these liberals, they hate this, they hate America. Look at this, they're out of the streets, they're protesting, they're blogging, they're doing progressive talk. They must just hate this guy. Why would you do all this if you didn't love your country? If you hated the country, you'd leave. I mean, it's pretty simple. It's pretty simple. Dan in San Diego, California. Hey, Dan, what's up?
I had a on the topic of asking religious questions of the candidates. And I think that's not so much morality as it's designed to get votes. The Republicans are viewed as the moral party, and they're just using it to embarrass Democrats and give get that religious.
But the
right.
Republicans are not the moral party, and that's what
I
point
know.
Out.
But they the perception is there, and then you'll get all the fundamentalists or the evangelicals or whatever you want to call them. They'll all vote in lockstep because, he took the wrong position here. And it's also the same reason why the Democrats, some of them don't want to debate on Fox. And it's a wise move. They're going to ask questions that they can design to elicit responses that they can use to beat the Democrats over the head with later on and do talking.
Right. They'll frame the debate.
Yeah.
They'll frame the debate.
Exactly.
And really the only way to respond to that when somebody tries to frame the debate, and politicians are generally pretty good at this, is essentially ignore the question and give the answer that you want to give. So, but the problem with Fox is then they come back and they say, no, you ignored the question. We really want to know about this blah de blah.
So, and the thing that's sort of another point, there's always two sides to every argument. There's always a converse, and the Democrats, for some reason, they just won't look at the converse. If they beat you over the head, we don't turn it around and say, you're asking an unfair question. You're asking an irrelevant question. For the life of me, I don't know why they don't do that.
Yeah. In fact, the last president who did that was Richard Nixon, where he got asked a tough question and he said, no, and I don't still beat my wife either, which was his way. The old question that there is no answer for. Do you still beat your wife? Well, no. I mean, yes. I mean, no. It's like, there is just no successful answer. Good point. And thanks for the call. Bob in Queens, New York. Hey, Bob, what's up?
I wanted to talk about your difference between conservatives and liberals. But first, I want to make a comment about religion. There will be a black president, a Jewish president, and a Muslim president in this country before there'll be an atheist president. And that's a sad fact, because the minute any candidate, when they start questioning him about his religion, if the public finds out he's an atheist, that's it, he's finished.
Well, actually, I disagree.
And that's a very sad.
We've already had an atheist president. Our first president, George Washington, was an atheist.
Okay, well, the public didn't know it, I don't think.
No. And it was a fairly well-kept secret. Jefferson wrote about it extensively in his diaries. Occasionally, Jefferson or Washington would toss out a gratuitous statement about religion, throwing red meat to the crowd, as it were. Madison, frankly, wrote most of his speeches because he wasn't a particularly articulate guy. But no, he was not religious at all.
But the sad fact is, I'm very insulted by the fact that these questioners on these debates are asking about religion. In 1960, what the public was worried about is that religion would take too much of John Kennedy's focus. Now it's totally turned around.
Right. Yeah, it has, and it's not a good thing. It's just very definitely not a good thing. Good point, Bob. Thank you very much. Charlie in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Charlie, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I woke to the newscast this morning. The bulletin was President Bush vetoes the stem cell bill, then hops on Air Force One to fly down to Alabama to reopen a nuclear plant that had been closed down because it was dangerous, and to promote nuclear energy as the new best form of energy right before he goes to a fundraiser. You think about what that's the embodiment of. If it wasn't so tragic, the irony would be comical. This guy he touts his own ethical basis. That's why he vetoed the stem cell bill, his own morality. And yet, when you look at his history, a guy who avoided service in Vietnam and even went AWOL from his little lame service to go work on a political campaign.
And spent a lot of time drinking. Because on the political game, he didn't even show up for most of the political
campaign. Exactly. Caging voters, black voters in Baghdad, and yet he uses the military as a prop every chance he gets. You know, when we talk about morality, I think it has to be deconstructed so far, because what we see now, it's really almost like, as I said, it would be comical if it weren't tragic. It's really sad.
You're absolutely right, Charlie, and it's a great example. Thank you. Paul in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Paul.
Good morning, sir. Thanks for all you do. Your points are well taken. I think what we have to do now is we need to guarantee that we never elect a debacle like we've done. And the steps that we need to take are the question that I pose to you. What are we going to do so that we don't let this repeat itself? Because if we don't do something about putting these people in jail or impeaching them, we're just lining ourselves up for another run like
right.
this.
We have to do what the people in the Ukraine did. You know, when they got out in the street, the Orange Revolution. We have to do what Bernie Sanders talks about almost every week on this program. We have to do what I call for at the end of every program. We have to get involved. Just voting isn't enough. There were not enough American citizens out. You had Tom DeLay's entire staff being flown down to Washington and or down to Florida in 2000 to pound on the windows, and Judge Roberts going down there to teach people how to argue before Rehnquist, who he used to clerk for so that Bush could successfully do his lawsuit to stop the vote from being counted in Florida. The Republicans got their base out. They got their people out. They got their people to show up. And we've got to get out there and not just, you know, in the PR way, the PR stunt way. In fact, during the election of 2000, you had 200-300 people every night standing outside the Naval Observatory, the vice president's office, Al Gore's house, shouting, "Get out of our house, let Dick Cheney in." This was before the election was even decided by the Supreme Court. We need to get active.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
6 minutes past the hour, the top of our second hour here. Tom Hartman with you. John Lott Jr. is on the line with us. He's the author of a new book, Freedomnomics, Why the Free Market Works and Other Half-Baked Theories Don't. A rebuttal to Freakonomics and more. John Locke, Jr., Ph.D., welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
And I should mention your website is johnrlott.com. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, great. In your book, there's a few assumptions. I mean, you talk about half-baked here. Let's talk about this. Your third chapter, Government is Nirvana. You say people frequently call for government intervention in the economy whenever the market is believed to be acting imperfectly. And then, you know, go through some examples of this. The predicating assumption of this is that the market exists independent of government. I would challenge you on that and say that the market is created by government.
Well, I mean, first of all, let me say I don't believe the market's perfect. I believe that there are plenty of flaws that exist in the market. I think the government helps define what the market is by protecting people's property rights and by making sure that certain rules exist there. But I think you probably have a lot of markets that exist even without government allowing, you know, trying to help them out in any way.
If you and I are neighbors and I paint your house and you wash my car, that's a deal. You know, that arguably that's a market, but that's not what we're talking about here. And that's not what you're talking about in your book. You're talking about the marketplace in the United States that involves corporations and individuals and all that, and around the world as well. And you say, well, you know, one of those common methods of government intervention is to encourage certain beneficial actions through subsidies, and then you proceed to take that apart. Am I properly characterizing your book?
But I mean, I think of the market in the free market in the broadest terms, but surely what you're talking about is one part of the market. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, but you're advocating basically the Milton Friedman Chicago School
exactly.
of Economics. In fact, toward the end of the book, you even say Milton Friedman is right, you know, and it's hard to dispute and all that sort of thing. And I would submit to you that there is no such thing as a free market. that the market is something that we have created. We create a court system to enforce it. We create laws to define it. We create a tax system that allows to fund the commons, that allows the market to exist. And the question, the real question, and you don't address it at all in your book, is the market here to support the public good? Is the market here to do something useful and positive for we, the people of the United States of America? Or are we just fodder for the market, for the people who own the market, essentially, that small aristocracy and elite that own the majority of the wealth, which is the market?
Well, I mean, I think I do try to address that in many ways. I think the market does increase wealth, and I think it does. Freedom is associated with people being wealthier. I think
how?
When you say that when
how?
Well, okay. I was just
how is it? How is it that if you have robber barons, that you have more freedom?
Question. Let me just finish answering your first question. I think one of the important things to recognize with the market is that we're talking about trades that exist. When you go to the grocery store and you buy a product, you value the product more than the money you're giving up, and they value the money more than the product that they're giving up. So both people gain from that transaction. And I think that's largely representative of what happens in the market. I mean, you work for Air America, and presumably you value the money more than the services you're giving them, and the reverse is true for the company that pays your salary statement.
Well, actually, I would, using that as an example, I would submit that there's a whole lot more variables than that, because I've been doing this program for 5 years, and it's my own business, and for the first four of those, well, actually, I don't even want to get into that. The point is that you're trying to apply microeconomics to macroeconomics. The big picture here is that there is a marketplace in the United States and around the world that has been established originally was established by government of, by, and for the people, and now is increasingly being established by multinational corporations, and particularly behind the scenes. I mean, here we have like the Walton heirs donating hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of dollars to this effort to redefine the estate tax as the death tax, so that people will be against a tax that only hits two one-hundredths of 1% of the population, 0.2% of the population. And it's basically the Paris Hilton tax, the rich kids tax, which I'm guessing you're opposed to as well.
I think companies use, in the broader sense here, you try to turn to government to get all sorts of favors. I guess I view the taxes as being different, but I'd like to see a reduction in government intervention there. I think that when you have the government being able to give out favors and regulate things, then different people will lobby the government to try to get those regulations tilted in their direction. And I think that,
well, and this is one
of
the,
a lot of harm.
This is one of the areas where I don't disagree with you, that an enormous amount of harm is done by companies lobbying government. In my opinion, the solution is to get the money out of government. But you don't want people lobbying government either, in as much as you don't think that the government should be doing things to, you know, give away programs in your mind, like Social Security, for example.
But let's just back up a second here. I think when we talk about prices, so we want to have price controls on something like pharmaceutical products, or this week they're debating.
Nobody's arguing for price controls in pharmaceuticals. They're arguing for competition.
No.
And the Republicans made competition in the pharmaceutical industry illegal, at least with regard to Medicare.
If you want to have the government go and set the price for what the drugs are going to be, I don't view that as competition.
Nobody is suggesting, or nobody ever has suggested, that government should set the price. The government should be able to go to five different companies that are making a product and say, give us your best price. Right now, by law, because Billy Towson pushed this thing through, and then as soon as it became law, went and became the $2 million a year head of pharma, the lobbying organization for the big drug companies. It's illegal for the federal government to do what the Veterans Administration does, what Walmart does, what Costco does, what every company that sells pharmaceuticals does, every drugstore in America does. Give us your best wholesale price.
Yeah, but there are lots of drugs where we have patents on there, and there's only going to be one producer of many different types of drugs.
Well, you can still say, okay, instead of buying 25 at the retail level, I'm going to buy 25,000. Give me your best price.
Right, but the problem is, if the government's the sole purchaser of this, kind of like what we do with childhood vaccines, there's nobody that's producing new childhood vaccines. The Clinton administration had it so that you're not allowed to go and directly sell childhood vaccines to people out there. The government purchases it, and then that turns around and resells them. And if you're not willing to go and accept the price the government's going to pay for it, they're not going to buy it. And they
so are you saying that people don't vaccine
so
their kids?
They can recoup the investments that are there, and there are no new childhood vaccines. If I'm 80 years old, I may think it's great that drugs are cheap. But if I, you know, if I'm not going to be around for 5 years, who cares whether there's going to be new drugs coming out? But if I'm 20 or 30 or 40 or 50, I better hope that these companies are going to be able to recoup the investments that they make. The
well, the flip side of that argument is that there's a whole bunch of diseases out there. There are the big diseases that's very profitable to go after, and then there are diseases that affect a relatively small number of people, a few thousand people, tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people, that it's not all that profitable to go after.
If you get your way where the government's going to be the purchaser of these things and the government's going to be able to determine what the price is going to be, you're not going to even have innovations for even the big diseases anymore.
Why not?
Because you have to be able to recoup these costs. You can't just...
So you negotiate with the government. The government's just us. It's just another customer.
Look at the way other countries like Canada go and bargain over drug prices.
Right, which is illegal here.
Fortunately, because if in Canada, for example, if you don't start selling your drug within 2 years after you start selling in the United States, you lose your patent and they give it to somebody else.
So the Canadian
government
says,
you take the price where you just cover your cost of producing each pill, or we're not going to let you sell it, and then we'll get your patent. The companies never recoup any of their development costs that they're. Sure, Canada gets
if they choose to screw the people.
The point is, the people are going to be screwed because they're going to die if they don't get new drugs being produced.
So you really believe that if company A decides that they're going to give up on the patent on that product, that company B isn't going to come along, make it generic, make it cheaper, and make it available? Because they can make a profit on it? As long as there's a demand for it, there's going to be somebody making it.
If there's no patent on it and they're not able to charge more than just the cost of stamping out each pill, nobody's going to step in to try to produce a new drug.
In other words, there's no such thing as a generic drug industry.
No, but the point is generic, that's after you've had a patent for 17 years and you've been able to recoup the cost, then it's very cheap to take a drug that's already developed and just go and cover your production costs.
Yeah. We're talking with John Lott. He's the author of Freakonomics, Why the Free Market Works and Other Half-Baked Theories. Freedomnomics, thank you. And other half-baked theories don't. Hey, John, can you stick around for a minute?
I'd be happy to.
Or for about, about 8 minutes. I want to talk to you about voting rights and voting machines. You have a very interesting chapter in your book on that. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
They say that Richard Corey owns one half of this whole town with political connections to spread his wealth around. Born into society, a banker's only child, he had everything a man could want, power, grace, and style. But I work in his factory, and I curse the life I'm living, and I curse my poverty, and I wish that I could be, oh, I wish that I could be, oh, I wish that I could be Richard Corey.
Actually, I think I'd pass. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. John Lott Jr. is on the phone with us. JohnRLott.com, his website. He's the author of a new book, Freedomnomics, Why the Free Market Works and Other Half-Baked Theories Don't. Those half-baked theories, I'm assuming in your mind, including things like the New Deal, John?
I would be critical of a lot of that, yeah.
Yeah. Voting machines, you have a chapter here titled Voting Rights and Voting Wrongs. And in your voting machines and voting chapter, you suggest that, you say critics are wrong in charging that this aberration cost Gore the election. We're talking about the hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of disenfranchised African Americans. Critics are wrong in charging that this aberration cost Gore the election, for the group most victimized by non-voted ballots was, in fact, African American Republicans. You go on to say that the results are indeed disturbing. They indicate that if there was a conspiracy to disenfranchise some group of Florida voters, that effort was directed at Republicans, not at African Americans as a race. How can you say that when it's common knowledge that it was the Republican Party under Catherine Harris that bought the phony list and that was engaging in caging down in Florida that knocked some 80, 90,000 African Americans off the voting rolls illegally?
No, and you're comparing a couple different issues that are unrelated, and you're getting them both wrong. The second issue about who has been removed from the voting rolls, if you're talking about the felons, and people like that.
They were felons in Texas, not in Florida, although the people with the same name in Florida.
I mean, I worked on the U.S. Civil Rights Commission minority report on that, and I authored a lot of that work. So, I know about the fact that there were claims that when they were trying to remove felons from the rolls, that they improperly or removed some people who weren't felons at the time. But if you break down those people who were removed, African Americans were actually removed at a smaller rate than their share of the population. So, you know,
well, they are a smaller share of the population.
I know, but even smaller than their share.
Okay, so in other words, the Republicans were successful in caging white Democrats more effectively than they were black Democrats.
No, they were more successful in going after whites, per se, but there's no evidence that I've seen anything that they tended to be white Democrats. They just tend to be white.
Well, you say the Republicans were the victims of this, and yet the Democratic Party had no organized plan to disenfranchise voters, whereas the Republican Party had a clear and well-publicized plan to disenfranchise voters.
If you look at the counties in Florida that had the highest rate of non-voted ballots, those were overwhelmingly in counties where the Democrats controlled the election bureaus there.
Let me just toss the biggest picture, the biggest question.
But can I just say one thing? Can I just
sure.
say one thing? I worked with, the study came out of work that I did for USA Today. Especially USA Today put together an amazing amount of data at the precinct level, matched it with the census. And the result that you're talking about is I just took the regression results that the other experts had done, where they looked at seeing whether the non-voted ballot rate, these are either overvotes or undervotes, as a function of the percentage of the people in each
Yeah, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about people who showed up and were told, sorry, you can't vote, even though you're a citizen, even though you're a registered voter, because your name got put on a list and you're being challenged by these Republicans at the polls.
No. You go look at Mary Frances Berry's hearings on that. And they could not identify specific cases. I mean, when they went down there and held hearings, they did not have people coming forward and say, yes, I was one.
The ACLU still has a class action lawsuit going on about this.
Look, if you read the report, about the only thing they had was they say, well, there was a mile from the pole, there was a police car, and somebody felt that maybe the police car was being intimidated, but even that person voted.
And it wasn't even a police car. It was a Republican operative behaving like a cop. I mean, that was just another example of all this stuff. But here's the big question, John. Do you believe that it is appropriate to privatize the beating heart of democracy, our vote? Do you think it's appropriate that a private corporation, Choice Point, was given the responsibility for deciding who could and could not vote? And do you believe that it's appropriate that private corporations like ES&S and Diebold be telling us who voted and refuse to give us the source code and tell us how that they know that we voted that way?
So you're telling me that government, when it does things, couldn't possibly be biased?
I'm saying that government, when it's transparent, is answerable to its people, and corporations are answerable to their board of directors and profit.
Look, biases, I'm willing to concede, can exist in every place in the world. It's just that I think companies, people who have their own money at stake, if they're going to lose these contracts, if they're found to be doing something wrong, they're more likely to worry about getting it right than
So you think it's better to privatize our elections?
I don't mind doing that. I think if it runs more efficiently, that'd be great.
Okay. John,
there's so many
John Arlott.
Go ahead.
No, I know. I understand. JohnArlott.com, the website. Freedonomics, the book. Thanks, John.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Sky, the stars, the sea, 365.
34 minutes past the hour. Checking out our live chat room over at TomHartman.com and AirAmerica.com/Tom Hartman page, and our blog over at AirAmerica.com/Tom Hartman page for in David's a weird view of the world at the end of the day will be, in his opinion, his favorite post. And we'll send that person a copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, What We Can Do About It, that's just now out in paperback. The some just absolutely mind-boggling stories out. This posted over at Crooks and Liars, but it's from the mainstream media. It's from CBS News. While the U.S. military searches for a soldier missing in Iraq, kidnapped by insurgents possibly allied with Al-Qaeda. You know this guy who was kidnapped? And they're looking all over the place for him? His wife back home in Massachusetts may be deported by the U.S. government. Army Specialist Alex Jimenez, who has been missing since his unit was attacked by insurgents in Iraq on May 12th, had petitioned for a green card for his wife, Yadirlin Geraldo, whom he married in 2004. Their attorney, Matthew Colkin, says 23-year-old Geraldo illegally entered the United States in 2001 to reunite with her husband, who she had met in her native Dominican Republic, and later married at his New York State Army base in 2004. So, let's see. The guy who is missing in Iraq, who may be a hostage in Iraq, his wife, here in the United States, maybe missing, he's missing as a consequence of Iraqi insurgents. His wife may be missing from the United States as a consequence of the Republican Party. Might want to let your legislators know how you think about that. My thinking on this whole issue is evolving slowly. I am still absolutely concerned that we have an illegal employer problem, not an illegal immigrant problem in the United States. In fact, the Bush administration just came out with a study, the Council of Economic Advisors, Bush's Council of Economic Advisors, saying that the native-born American workers benefit from immigration by more than $30 billion a year. Now, they don't. It makes no sense, though. I mean, this from the Financial Times. It concedes unskilled immigrants may put downward pressure on the position of unskilled native workers. It also recognizes unskilled immigrants may impose a very small fiscal cost on the government, and that more immigration will not solve the problem of financing Social Security and Medicare. So it kind of, you know, it's like in the fine print, it's, you know, the report says that immigration changes the relative supply of factors such as unskilled labor, skilled labor, and capital economy. It finds the fiscal gains from skilled immigration greatly exceed those from unskilled immigration. So in other words, what they're doing is they're saying, okay, these folks who are coming in to work for Microsoft, the engineers, they're adding to the economy because they're, you know, they're taking high-paid jobs. Let's ignore the fact that they're taking high-paid jobs away from Americans. They're you know, generating, in fact, it says, citing a study that estimates skilled immigrants and their descendants contributed a net $198,000 on average to public financing. On the other hand, those people who are coming in without skills, which is the vast majority of the people that we're talking about giving amnesty to, while those only with a high school diploma cost the government a net $13,000. I think the picture, though, is much bigger than this. And my concern is that if we are going to give amnesty to well over 10 million people who are in the United States illegally, and it looks like it's going to happen, I think it should be, and there's no way to stop it, I think that it should be done sooner rather than later. And I say, you know, my sister-in-law has immigrated to the United States legally. She has a green card. She's going through and...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Minutes past the hour, checking out our live chat room over at TomHartman.com and AirAmerica.com airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page and our blog over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page for in David's a weird view of the world at the end of the day will be, in his opinion, his favorite post. And we'll send that person a copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, What We Can Do About It, that's just now out in paperback. The some just absolutely mind-boggling stories out. This post over Crooks and Liars, but it's from the mainstream media. It's from CBS News. While the U.S. military searches for a soldier missing in Iraq, kidnapped by insurgents possibly allied with Al-Qaeda. You know this guy who was kidnapped? And they're looking all over the place for him? His wife back home in Massachusetts may be deported by the U.S. government. Army Specialist Alex Jimenez, who has been missing since his unit was attacked by insurgents in Iraq on May 12th, had petitioned for a green card for his wife, Yadderlin Geraldo, whom he married in 2004. Their attorney, Matthew Colkin, says 23-year-old Geraldo illegally entered the United States in 2001 to reunite with her husband, who she had met in her native Dominican Republic, and later married at his New York State Army base in 2004. So, let's see. The guy who is missing in Iraq, who may be a hostage in Iraq, his wife, here in the United States, may be missing. He's missing as a consequence of Iraqi insurgents. His wife may be missing from the United States as a consequence of the Republican Party. Might want to let your legislators know how you think about that. My thinking on this whole issue is evolving slowly. I am still absolutely concerned that we have an illegal employer problem, not an illegal immigrant problem in the United States. In fact, the Bush administration just came out with a study, Bush's Council of Economic Advisors, saying that the native-born American workers benefit from immigration by more than $30 billion a year. Now, they don't. It makes no sense, though. I mean, this from the Financial Times. It concedes unskilled immigrants may put downward pressure on the position of unskilled native workers. It also recognizes unskilled immigrants may impose a very small fiscal cost on the government and that more immigration will not solve the problem of financing Social Security and Medicare. So it kind of, you know, it's like in the fine print, it's, you know, the report says that immigration changes the relative supply of factors such as unskilled labor, skilled labor, and capital and economy. It finds the fiscal gains from skilled immigration greatly exceed those from unskilled immigration. So in other words, what they're doing is they're saying, okay, these folks who are coming in to work for Microsoft, the engineers, they're adding to the economy because they're, you know, they're taking high-paid jobs. Let's ignore the fact that they're taking high-paid jobs away from Americans. They're you know, generating, in fact, it says, citing a study that estimates skilled immigrants and their descendants contributed a net $198,000 on average to public financing. On the other hand, those people who are coming in without skills, which is the vast majority of the people that we're talking about giving amnesty to, while those only with a high school diploma cost the government a net $13,000. I think the picture, though, is much bigger than this. And my concern is that if we are going to give amnesty to well over 10 million people who are in the United States illegally, and it looks like it's going to happen, I think it should be. And there's no way to stop it. I think that it should be done sooner rather than later. And I say, you know, my sister-in-law has immigrated to the United States legally. She has a green card. She's going through and what's turning out to be about an 8-year process to become a U.S. citizen. And, you know, so I guess I have a dog in this fight. At least I have an understanding of the process. I mean, I've been down to the INS. I had to write the letters of, yes, you know, she really is the wife of my brother-in-law. Yes, they really do love each other and live together. Yet, no, this isn't a sham marriage, you know, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. But my concern is that what this immigration bill is doing is it's setting up a guest worker program. It's setting up a bracero program. It's setting up a slave labor program. And that's the reason that the Bush administration is pushing it. And frankly, I think the Democrats are making a mistake and not saying, okay, either do it or don't do it. You know, do it like Reagan did in 86 and just say, okay, fine, you're citizens now, you can vote. Which will cause the disenfranchised and, by and large, underpaid, quote, illegal immigrants, once they become legal citizens, will cause them to side with the Democrats. Instead of saying, okay, you got a 5-10 year path to immigration, in other words, for at least 5 or 10 years, you can't vote, you can't participate in the political process. We're going to make sure that it's just rich white guys, by and large. And it's just, you know, very strange. Michelle in Orange County, California. Hey, Michelle, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you today?
I am fine. I've been running on 3 hours sleep, but I'm fine.
I hear you, and I will get better.
I just
wanted to let everybody know that's listening that every day when you say tag, you're it. Actually, there are people listening. I'd have to say in the last 6 months, I've done some really serious actions. I occupied Ed Royce's office, who is my congressman. I occupied his office until he guaranteed on July 5th that he'll meet with myself and other military families in regards to his continued warmongering. It really does
good
work
on you, Michelle.
People really, really need to know this. And I just wanted to let you guys know that you kind of motivated this one. My brother and I were listening to your radio, and we were talking about how George Bush really needs to be taken out of the equation, not, you know what I mean, just removed.
Yeah. Politically.
Yeah. I'm not threatening him in any way. I just wanted to let everybody know there's an org that my brother and I were cracking up about how, because when you have to actually pick something to be mad about and there's 500 of them, we decided that, you know, forget this guy. We're going to send him a moving box. We've talked to Congress and asked to get him removed. We've asked, you know, representatives. We've asked neighbors. We've asked friends. A really good group of activists and artists and students and doctors and just citizens from all over the country have decided that this week what we're doing is we're sending George Bush a moving box. Because, I mean, really, if you got a moving box, what else is it except get out, you no longer represent me? And some people have been conflicted, saying, well, that's a really stupid idea. But in reality, it's for $3.08, you can send a moving box to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and let that man know yourself, I want you removed. You no longer represent me. And it was motivated from you. So thank you, sir.
You're welcome, and thank you, Michelle. And it's great that you're doing that. It's just absolutely marvelous. And in fact, I would say yes, Michelle, we caught you doing something right. Congratulations, well done. So, 42 minutes past the hour. David in New York City. Hey, David. David.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Okay. I just wanted to point out to you that this immigration bill that's being hustled through by the Republican and Democratic leadership is a sham. It's just to make the issue go away and to get the Bracero program, slave labor program, as you said, working, because the 10 million people who would get the amnesty, the deal is they're not only pay a fine, but they leave the country, leave their businesses and their families, and come and then apply to see if maybe they can get back in. So they're not going to get anybody to take them up on that. So the whole thing is just to make the issue go away.
Well, and it's this two-tiered thing about it, too. Those people who are most likely to compete with union workers, the skilled workers, they're the ones who are going to have a relatively well-greased path to citizenship and an incentive to stay in the country. Those people who are basically like, you know, farm labor, migrant workers, quote, unskilled workers, end quote, those are the ones who are going to have to go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, which is how it always was. And that's the major reinvention of the Bracero program. So it's a twofer for the Bush administration. They get to destroy unions and they get people in, into the Bracero program, into a slave labor program. Lewis in Los Angeles. Hey, Lewis.
Hey, Tom. A minute ago, you mentioned that Reagan just gave amnesty in the Immigration Reform and Control Act back in '86. And at the time, I was working at a law firm, and I also worked with Catholic Charities, working with a lot of these people. And the people, in order to qualify for that, had to prove that they had been in the country 14 years and that they had, you know, not been criminals and all.
No, I know that. But you and I both know that there was a huge black market, an underground market in documentation for that kind of thing. And a lot of people who had been in the country for a week got citizenship.
Well, That's true. I heard about
it was massive
letters of recommendation being bought and sold. But there are a lot of people that went by the book on it, and you know they got credit for having been part of the community and having given into it.
Yeah, no, and my point is, if progressives are going to go along with an immigration bill, and you know if it's inevitable, if it's coming down the road, then we want these people voting as quickly as possible, not off in the distant future, because these people are most likely to be consistent in their worldview with the progressive worldview. They're the people. They're the bottom of the economic ladder. They're the ones who are most likely to vote Democratic. And I think that's one of the reasons why Bush wants a bill that makes sure that these people will not be able to vote for 6, 8, 10, 12 years. So, you know, it's I think the Democrats are shooting themselves in the foot on this. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
As I walked out tonight in the mystic garden, the wounded flowers were dangling from the vine. I was passing by a young, cool crystal fountain. Someone hit me from behind. I ain't talking, just walking through this weary world of the world. Hot burning, still yearning. No one on earth would ever know. They say
okay, over at the blog at airamerica.com, airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page, more white right-wing libertarian flakes, writes Balak, I guess it is. And more of this crap. Yesterday, Ben Swanger. Today, John Lott Jr. Is this what your progressive listeners need to hear? You know, I get emails like this from time to time, or people post blogs over at our website. And, you know, why are you putting the right wing on your program? They've got, you know, they own the media. They've got, you know, you got Glenn Beck. You've got all these, you know, wall-to-wall right wing all over the place. Why put it on Progressive Talk Radio? Because nobody else is talking back to them. Because we all have people like this in our families. Because we have people like this that we work next to. And I think in America, if we're going to pull this country together rather than break it apart, and the reason why I have these conversations in a very different way than the old Hardball show and most of the right-wing shows where they're trying to get some inarticulate idiot on and then just beat them up, and then afterwards, after they take them off the air, trash them and take them apart and make fun of them. I don't do that. Instead, I think that what we have to do is we have to, number one, highlight their talking points and their beliefs, the beliefs behind their talking points, so the people actually understand where these guys are coming from. They don't believe, for example, in the commons. I mean, that was the essence of the conversation we just had. Sure, privatized voting, the most vital of the commons. They don't believe in small-d democracy. They believe in an aristocracy. So let's, number one, put them in a forum where their actual views are actually out there. And number two, you know, hopefully, in a fairly articulate fashion, I can refute those and provide you with the ammunition to win the water cooler wars and give you a model for how to have these kinds of discussions with your brother-in-law. And at the end of the day, he's still your brother-in-law, and you can still be friends. So that's why I do it and why I'm going to continue to do it. And I think it makes good radio as well. I think that the most deadly boring radio is to hear people say, yeah, I agree with you. No, I agree with you. Yes, I agree with you. Anyhow, speaking of disagreements, Bill in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, babe, Bill.
Hello?
Bill? Yeah, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Been listening for a while. Nothing really major, just one slight correction on George Washington. George Washington was a Freemason, and to be a Freemason, you have to believe in God. We don't care what
you call them. You have to be a deist, is that your point? At least you have to claim that you're a deist. Well, first of all, do you know that was the case among the Freemasons in 1776?
We have a lot of writing from that time.
Okay. Because here's, this is from Thomas Jefferson's diary, February 1st, 1799. He was simply writing to himself. He says, when the clergy addressed General Washington on his departure from the government, it was observed in their consultation that he had never, on any occasion, ever said a word in public which showed any belief whatsoever in the Christian religion. And they thought they should so pen their address as to force him to publicly declare whether or not he was a Christian. However, the old fox was too cunning for them. He answered every article of their address except that which he passed over without notice. He went on to say Washington, quote, never did say a word on the subject in any of his public papers except in his valedictory letter to the governors of the states when he resigned his commission in the army, wherein he speaks of, quote, the benign influence of the Christian religion, end quote. He says, I know that Governor Morris, who is in his secrets, in other words, in Washington's confidence, has often told me that General Washington believed no more in that Christian system than he himself did. And Morris was an atheist. So, I'll take it from the mouth of a guy who was good friends with George Washington until the day they died. He felt a fellow Virginian and a fellow founder. Washington, maybe he wasn't what we would call in modern language an atheist. He certainly was not a Christian. He was a deist at the very best. So, anyhow, Ted, I just make that point. Bill, thanks for the call. Ted in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Ted.
Good morning, Tom. Say, you mentioned the threefer that Bush is getting from this immigration debate. I think you mentioned the twofer. I think he's actually getting a threefer because he's diverting the debate away from other more pressing issues that he's actually losing ground on, like the war and some other issues.
Right. Plus, he's getting cannon fodder. I mean, let's keep in mind that the first guy who died in Iraq was an illegal alien who was trying to get his citizenship by joining the U.S. Army. So, yeah, good point and well made, Tim. Or Ted, excuse me. Susan in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hey, Susan.
Hi, Tom. It's my ultimate pleasure to speak with you, and I'm glad that you're here educating people of Baton Rouge. But I want to make a very good point that I heard something about just this last week. This veto of the stem cell bill, I want everybody to follow the money. I don't believe it's about ethics and morals. I think it's about money and selling off our national science to private companies so that they can patent all of the great research that is going to happen.
Right. If the federal government doesn't do it and keep it in the public domain, then private companies will do it. They'll lock it down and they will make any cures that come out of this mind-bogglingly expensive. And so it will work to the benefit of the very wealthy and to hell with the average American person, which is basically the subtext of the entire Republican Party.
I want this message out there. I want everyone. I don't know how to do it. I'm going to write letters to the editor. I want everyone to know in this Bible-thumping town that they have a fraud for a president, that it's not about protecting the unborn.
Well, it's, I mean, you know, the fertilized blastocysts are not even the unborn. I mean, they have not been implanted.
Yeah, believe me, I use that word in parentheses.
Yeah,
but
it's
your advice on how to do it is much appreciated. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Susan. Thanks for the call. There is, you know, it's like a scandal a day. You know, it's just a scandal a day. Financial Times, the lead editorial today. One more big win for Wall Street. Corporate America has a powerful new friend in Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court. Yeah, Alito and Scalia, decision after decision, they go through a whole list of them, screwing the average worker, helping out transnational corporations. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Well, when we marched down Grand River Avenue in East Lansing in the late 1960s at Michigan State University, members of SDS and hangers-on and just generally folks who were opposed to the war, we were confronted by the city police, by the campus police, by state police. I don't have a specific recollection of being confronted by the National Guard. I do have a specific recollection of inhaling either CN or CS gas and tear gas. But we never thought that the special operations forces of the U.S. Army would be there shooting at us. Because it was against the law. It was something that just wasn't done. In Pakistan right now, or in Pakistan right now, because there was a military coup, and Musharraf took over a democratically elected government. Now in Pakistan, individual citizens fear the military. The military is running the country. But in the United States, virtually from the founding of this country, and certainly since the passage of the Posse Comitatus Act right after the Civil War, we collectively all agreed we don't ever want the power of the U.S. military, a mind-bogglingly powerful force, turned against us. And yet in the John Warner Defense Appropriations Act and arguably in the Military Commissions Act, several pieces of legislation have chipped away at this to the point where, for all practical purposes, the Posse Comitatus Act, the law of, I believe it was 1878, I might be wrong on the year, is dead. And now, instead of, you know, if you're out protesting, instead of, you know, the local police saying, hey, you know, get down the street, or, you know, you're not supposed to be here, or get off this street, or we're going to throw some tear gas at you, you may be facing Black Hawk helicopters and special operations forces, people who are trained not in crowd control. The U.S. Army is not trained in crowd control. They're trained in blowing things up and killing people. I mean, this is downright spooky. The National Review, writing an article about this, U.S. military command in charge of protecting the homeland, and there's that word again, the homeland. That word that was first brought into the lexicon in Germany by Rudolf Hess. Heimat. The homeland. It used to be, you know, Germany. It used to be America. It used to be the United States. It used to be our domestic. You know, prior to the Bush administration, I had never heard the word homeland reference to America. I lived in Germany back in the 80s and read Scheer's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, and I realized that even the Germans had never heard the word homeland until in 1934 at the Nuremberg rallies, Rudolf Hess got up and said, Dank Ihre Führer, Ihren Führer, thanks to the Führer, Germany has now become a homeland, a Heimat, for all the Germans in the world. Alles die Deutsche über die ganze Welt. Well, in fact, here it is.
Dank Ihrer Führung wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen, Heimat zu sein.
Heimat zu sein.
Heimat zu sein für alle Deutschen der Welt. Adolf Hitler! Sieg Hitler! Sieg Hitler!
That was Rudolf Hess introducing the word homeland to the Germans in 1934. Now we've got the word homeland in the United States. And Hess and Hitler were very, very specific in doing this. They borrowed it from the Zionist movement in an effort to try to, you know, which was trying to create a homeland for displaced Jews back long before World War II. And basically their thinking was, let's create a racial identity for a country, for the German country. And they did. It was one of the cores of Nazism. It's the ultimate us-them. Now, you can argue if you have an ethnic group or if you have a religious group that has historically been in an area, that that is the homeland for that area. Native Americans, for example, could argue that that North America is their homeland. And I think with some legitimacy. But using that phrase in a demagogic fashion, this is the great melting pot. This is not the homeland. So anyhow, back to the article in the National Review. The U.S. military command in charge of protecting the homeland asked the Pentagon earlier this year for a contingent of special operations officers to help with domestic anti-terrorism missions. Military sources told the Examiner the U.S. Northern Command, established at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado in 2002, requested its own Special Operations Command, similar to ones assigned to fighting to overseas war fighting commands, such as the U.S. Central Command. The request was approved 6 months ago by the then commander of NORTHCOM, Admiral Timothy Keating, who has since moved to the U.S. Pacific Command. So the U.S. Army is now fielding special operations forces inside the United States to use against, quote, domestic terrorists, end quote. And we have terrorist legislation that has said that you are a terrorist if you interrupt the economic activity of a corporation. If you stand out in front of McDonald's and say, eat vegetarian, you are a terrorist. For example, I mean, it's perhaps an extreme example, that Bush can declare essentially anybody a terrorist. And now, because Posse Comitatus has gone away, you may be facing not, you know, the local police who live in the same community as you do and have and are answerable to the to a locally elected police chief and a mayor. And if they really screw up, there's going to be hell to pay for it. Not the local National Guard like in Ohio, where it's under the control of the governor and, the people who live in the state. And, you know, they killed those people in Kent State, and there was an investigation. I would be the first to agree with you that it was a whitewash, and that it was just in the last few months that we actually finally found the tape where we heard the ready, aim, fire. But at least they were claiming that it was accidental or they thought it was in self-defense. And it was a local militia that was locally responsible and locally controlled. And now Bush wants to field a military where they can pull soldiers from Florida and from South Carolina and from North Carolina and from Kentucky and from and put them into Los Angeles, where there is where they don't have a sense of local control. Their only loyalty is to Bush, and not necessarily Los Angeles either. I mean, it could just as easily be in Denver, or just as easily be in Seattle, or just as easily be in Detroit, wherever. And do what the military is trained to do, which is not crowd control. It's taking people out. Maybe pick them up as they're going down the street and extraordinarily render them to Egypt where they can be tortured. The article goes on to note that Keating's decision has, quote, raised some eyebrows because of the sensitivity of deploying commandos domestically. Yeah, it's raised my eyebrows. It's being reviewed by the new NORTHCOM commander, Air Force General Gene Renaud, or Renaud, R-E-N-A-U-R-T. This is just another example. You know, Rudy Giuliani's running around going, 9-11 this, 9-11 that, and everything changed in 9-11. This post-9-11 war. And Bush, of course, the same thing. And frankly, all of the Republican candidates. And what this is code for is, before 9-11, we had a democracy. After 9-11, we had an autocracy, a kleptocracy, and essentially a government that is moving so far to the Reich that it is indistinguishable in many regards from the governments that we saw in Europe in the 1930s and that we saw in South America in the 1970s and 1980s, and that is being repudiated by the people of South America, by and large. Lula da Silva, just you know, big victory just here in the last couple of days. People are turning it aside, but here in the United States, it's like the instruments, the mechanisms of oppression are growing. And there's just so much of it happening so fast. We must be active and we must be pushing back and we must hold it up to the light of day.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
The Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar. I am following the river down the highway through the cradle of the Civil War. I'm going to Graceland, Graceland.
Yeah, and it was that Civil War that taught us that we never never again want to have the power of the U.S. Army, the guns of the U.S. Army, pointed at the American people. That led directly to the Posse-Comitatus Act, which has been now, in the last 3 years, by Republicans in the House of Representatives in the Congress and signed into law by the President, has been basically taken down. And now they're saying, okay, the military can go after Americans. Absolutely amazing. By the way, according to a lawsuit, a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, this is from Agence France-Presse. Actually, it's from the group that did the lawsuit, which is Judicial Watch, Larry Klayman's group, the guy that originally tracked down Monica Lewinsky and started that whole thing, and then tracked down Cheney's energy policy. What they found, what they're saying they found, is that the FBI documents that they got under the Freedom of Information Act show that a Ryanair 727 airplane that departed Los Angeles International Airport on September 19, 2001 and was said to have carried Saudi nationals out of the United States. Remember all these flights carrying all of the Bin Laden family out of the U.S. in the week following 9/11? Quote, that plane was chartered either by the Saudi Arabian royal family or Osama bin Laden, according to the document. The flight made stops in Orlando, Florida, Washington, D.C., and Boston, Massachusetts. It eventually left its passengers in Paris the following day. In all, the documents detail six flights between September 14 and September 24 that evacuated Saudi nationals and bin Laden family members, the Judicial Watch said in a statement. Incredibly, not a single Saudi national nor any member of the bin Laden family members possessed any information of investigative value, Judicial Watch said. Yeah, right. Brian in Madrid, Spain, on the line. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Well, on the immigration topic, I just had a couple things I wanted to add. I'm currently living in Spain. I used to live in Portland, Oregon, right down the street from you.
Oh, great.
And the first is the Permanent Partners Immigration Act. I had to leave the U.S. about 8 months ago because I was married to a Spaniard who's a male, and because of the U.S. laws, we couldn't stay in the U.S. together. And I just, you know, all the talk of immigration and here, you know, an American successful business and company, I couldn't sponsor my partner. And
amazing.
The second
Spain thing, recognizes gay marriage?
Pardon?
Spain recognizes gay marriage?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, that's what
I thought. Our wedding was in Canada, and then the Spanish government took all the documents, translated them, and I immigrated to Spain with all my legal rights and considered a Spanish citizen in 6 months.
Wow. Wow.
And surprisingly, Spain right now has the largest influx of immigrants in the world, second only to the U.S. But the most impressive thing is that the government, the media, the television shows here tell people how wonderful the immigrants are, how they've added billions of euros to the economy, and El País, which is the most conservative paper in Spain, published a big headline saying we need 5 million more.
Now, are the immigrants that are coming into Spain mostly the poor, low-skilled folks coming from northern Africa, or are they people like yourself who are presumably well-educated and have a lot of skills and maybe bringing some money with them? Are those the majority of the immigrants coming into Spain?
No, the majority of immigrants coming into Spain are coming from two locations. Romania, after it joined the Union, they've come into Spain, and they're poor.
Right.
And tend to be undereducated, low-wage workers. The second is South America. The third largest immigrant group in Spain this year, 400,000 people, was from Ecuador.
Oh, that's interesting. But I would guess that they would tend to be those South Americans who have enough money and means to do it.
Nope. They have policies with South America because they need the lower-wage workers to continue building the roads, you know, the hospitals, work, you know, everything that the immigrants in our country are doing.
How does Spain maintain its middle class if its labor pool is being diluted? Is this the consequence of the reduction of, you know, the zero population, negative population growth in Spain?
It is a result of that. One was the Social Security system, much like the U.S., how we've, you know, heard most of my life. I'm 40. How it won't be there for me. Well, in Spain, the government recognized that, and instead of, you know, telling people to save money in the stock market, which is a bad idea, what they've done is they've encouraged, you know, the immigration to rebuild the workforce, increase the population, but at the same time they do something different, which is they're integrating them into Spanish society.
Right.
Something I remember from my history books the U.S. used to do. You know,
yeah.
My family immigrated
yeah.
to Ireland, so I find that interesting. It's just listening to the immigration topic over and over. I watch CNN still while I'm here, and I listen to your show
sure.
on the Internet,
yeah.
and it just surprises me how it's
And what's
not
Spain
even a question
doing?
Of,
what? Yeah, I understand. We only have a little less than a minute left before we've got to take a break.
Oh,
the what's the situation with regard to trade policies in Spain? I know the EU has kicked open an awful lot of doors, but are they aggressively trying to keep manufacturing within Spain?
Well, within the European Union, yes. One of the things that I see a huge difference on is the goods from, for example, from China.
Mm-hmm.
The European Union has tariffs in place. So you don't go buy a DVD player, for example, for, you know, 15 or 20 euros or $20, as you would Walmart in the U.S.
Right.
You know, they encourage the local economy and the local building and the local factories.
So Spain, particularly because they're bringing in a lot of low-wage workers, is becoming a manufacturing floor, or is it one of the manufacturing floors for the rest of Europe?
It is becoming. It's one of the agricultural centers of Europe.
Yeah. Well, it always has been that. That's very interesting. Brian, thanks for calling from Madrid, Spain, and giving us the update on that.
All right,
fascinating stuff. Appreciate it. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Coming up next, the best of the rest of the news.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Guys, again, we're going down the wrong road, my friend. Let's return our nation to its true destination. Let's be the good guys again.
What a fine idea.
Let's be one nation again and work for the common good, my friend. Let's
that sounds like
our highways,
radical
our
pinko commie stuff. What? Rebuild the commons? Rebuild our nation? Holy cow, we can't have that. Ronald Reagan taught us that. You know, as Reagan said, there are no good people in government. If there was any good people in government, private industry would have hired them away. Speaking of himself as well, I guess. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. It's our best of the rest of the news segment, where we invite in some of the I'm not even sure the word to use anymore, the blogosphere, the internet, whatever, some of the top bloggers and news sources out there on the internet, and ask them what, in their opinion, are the top news stories of the days and of the day and what they see coming down the road. Today we have Rob Call with opednews.com, the publisher and senior editor, and Mark Carlin, the founder and editor of buzzflash.com. And Rob, welcome.
Hey, Tom.
Great to have you with us. And Mark, welcome to you, too.
Good afternoon. Loved your reporting from the Take Back America conference.
Well, thank you. It was interesting. It wasn't anywhere near as much fun as doing the CPAC conference, the Conservative Political Action Conference. That was a good food fight, but we had a good time. Rob Call, opednews.com. What do you see as the biggest two stories in the news right now?
I think one that's not getting much attention that has a lot of potential is the news in yesterday's USA Today that people who are not married, who live together, are going to be subjected to the same disenfranchisement of rights that gay couples are being treated badly with.
In other words, get married or lose your partner benefits.
That's
if
right.
If you're straight.
Starting to apply the nasty rules that hurt gay couples to unmarried people. And these marriage advocacy groups are trying to pass a constitutional amendment that basically, if you don't live together, I mean, if you're not married and you live together, and there are more people who are not married now living together than there are married, it's going to hurt them. And what I think is,
well, but if you're living together, you're living in sin. So if you have a government that is operating based on religious principles, a theocracy, which is what Bush has brought us to a large extent, spent billions of dollars on it, then, you know, at a certain level, that makes perfect sense from a theocratic point of view.
Theocratically, yes. But I think this is going to bite back beautifully because there are so many people who are Republican who live together and who are not married, that they're not going to like this either. And his pandering to the extreme right-wing Christian fundamentalists is going to hurt him. And that's nice.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's hope so. From your lips to God's ears. Mark Carlin with BuzzFlash.com. Mark, what do you see as the top stories in today's news?
Certainly the breaking story today may have been mentioned on your program was that the vice president, meaning Dick Cheney, has asserted that his office is not an entity within the executive branch. And
right.
he said that in the context of his office not complying with executive branch requirements for preserving and taking precautions to safeguard classified national security information.
And to make it available to Congress when necessary.
And to make it available to Congress. Of course, that's dripping with irony, given the exposure of Valerie Plame as a CIA operative specializing in weapons of mass destruction. But it is simply incomprehensible, I think, to any American who might see that story, and it's going to be a story that's not going to get a lot of coverage, that Cheney is claiming this right to not safeguard classified national security according to executive branch standards because his office is not an entity within the executive branch.
Is he making that claim because he's the, according to the Constitution, he's the president of the Senate, and so you could argue, I suppose it would be thin ice argument, because the vice president is mentioned in Article 2 of the Constitution, not Article 1, but that you could argue that as president of the Senate, he's part of the legislative branch and not the executive branch?
I think that's an argument that he would have had a hard time making in court. I think it's simply typical Cheney, which is my rules are the rules I make. I'm above the law. I simply don't have to conform with any expectation of past or current standards other than the ones I choose. It's an astonishing claim that I think would shock most Americans were it to rise to the top of news. I don't suspect that it will. It came out of Henry Waxman's Government Reform Oversight Committee, and a complaint was made to Gonzalez to get Cheney to comply with the law, and Gonzalez said, we're not going to get involved with this, I don't think to anyone's surprise.
Well, and in fact, in 2004, we're talking about the Information Security Oversight Office. This is the agency that is supposed to be, you know, looking, making sure that classified information is actually being treated in a classified fashion and within the executive branch. And it was brought into being, oddly enough, ironically enough, in 2003 by an executive order, Executive Order 12958 by President Bush. And although it existed before that, he amended and endorsed it. And Cheney has ignored this. In 2004, he specifically intervened to block an inspection of his office by this Information Security Oversight Office. And now he's lobbying for Bush to write a new executive order exempting him. I mean, this is incredible.
Well, I think this speaks to the fundamental notion that this is a rogue regime, a runaway regime that feels absolutely no accountability to the American public. We pay their salaries, but they feel they have no responsibilities to uphold the law or to be responsible to the public. And that is particularly true of Cheney. He simply is someone who believes that no rule of law applies to him. And I think that ties into the big lie. I wanted to quickly mention another story that won't make it to the top, but that involves Tony Snow. John Stewart had a wonderful piece last week, which I'm sure some of your listeners saw, where Tony Snow denied to a reporter that the White House had ever said that these attorneys, U.S. prosecutors, were released because of performance issues. And then John Stewart showed a tape where 3 months ago Tony Snow said that they were released because of performance issues. So he lied. He just flat out lied. And John Stewart showed the two tapes back to back and had Tony Snow versus Tony Snow. But I think what that brings home is that this is an administration that doesn't try to get by parsing words so that technically they're not lying. They lie in a big way. They lie in the big, bold lie. And
but the amazing thing is they get away with it.
They get away.
I mean, John Stewart pointed it out, but ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, MSNBC, none of them pointed it out.
And that is true. They have found the big lie works. Because at the end of the day, if you're still in power, it doesn't matter if you've lied. And I think the networks have adopted that standard, that as long as the Bush administration and Cheney are still exercising power,
they're going to suck up to it.
If they lie, it doesn't matter, because the very fact they're still in power means that the lies don't account for anything.
Right. Rob Call at opednews.com. A, your thoughts on that, and B, what do you see as the coming stories, the things that are coming down the road that we might not be noticing?
Well, I think the other things I wanted to talk about tie in with what Mark said, and by the way, Buzzflash is a great site. They tie together because one of our articles by Phil Rockstro in our main headlines is about how they're all lying. When they tell us that when the Democrats tell us they don't have the votes to stop the war, that's a lie. All they have to do is refuse to fund any more in the House, and they can stop
right.
it. And
right.
so we have 14%, I understand today, there's a new poll out. The support for Congress is now at 14%. They're way below.
Well, that's because we elected them to end the war, and they didn't do it. They gave Bush what he wanted, and there's this broad perception that the Republicans just rolled over, or the Democrats just rolled over.
Right. So the other news is
Rob?
That there are people looking
I think
at
we've lost
another...
Rob.
Pardon me?
Mark?
Yes, I do think that one of the interesting things coming up is...
I'm here.
There we go. Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I can hear you both. I lost you through the ISDN line, but I can hear you on the Comrex.
Okay, so the other big issue that I think is developing is so many people are mad at the Congress, they're looking at another way to get things done because the Congress is not doing it. So we had an article last week that over 100,000 viewers looked at, and it was about the idea of an Article 5 constitutional convention to put forth new congressional laws, amendments, done circumventing Congress because they're not getting it done.
Yeah, I'm very concerned about a constitutional convention though, because there's too many Republicans. There's too much potential for mischief. But I understand the sentiment. There's a very strong sentiment out there that we've gone way too far and way too fast, and it's just the Constitution has been shredded. I think we just need to bring the damn thing back. Rob Call, opednews.com, Mark Carlin, buzzflash.com, two great websites. Check them out. Rob, Mark, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with both of you.
Thanks, Tom.
You're welcome, Rob. It's 45 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Stick around for the Randy Rhoads Show, coming up next on Air America Radio. Well, our book for the day, copy of our new paperback edition, signed by me, of our new book, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, which, if I do say most so myself, is one of my favorite books that I've written. It goes to Steph K29, who blogged over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. In our daily blog, and said, when I was in the voting booth in 2000 to cast my vote for Al Gore, the table of the booth literally fell out from under my pen. Granted, this booth was in a town in New England, founded in 1754, but I think it was pretty clear omen for the state of our democratic institutions and traditions since then. At the time, I just picked up the board and placed it back on its supports. I only wish it was that easy to repair the rest of the damage imposed on our nation since then. Well said. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Steven in Miami, Florida. Hey, Steven,
yeah.
What's on your mind?
Tom, I have two questions. One, last couple of months, have the Democrats done any polls to determine how Hillary Clinton stands compared to our Republican opponents?
I don't know, but let's ask. In fact, let's ask Ellen Ratner. She would be the expert on this, and I was just notified she's on the line from Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, in fact, there is one poll that, there's some other early primary states that she is having some problems with, but apparently in Nevada, she and Romney are the two on top, and so although she's done very well in generic polls, Hillary Clinton has had some trouble in state by state. And a part of the reason that I'm hearing sort of in the grapevine that the Obama people are so impossible to deal with around radio people, they just don't do much radio,
right,
is that his staff are basically saying it's his to lose.
Yeah. Well, I think he thinks that, and I think that Hillary thinks that, and pretty much everybody else is out there scrapping for, fighting for what they can get. What do you think about Al Gore getting into the race?
You know, I actually just, again, I was at the Take Back America contest, where
conference.
Conference.
Where you and I were yesterday.
Were.
Yes.
And as you know, I ran into some of my very old Washington buddies who have their ear to the ground. And what I just heard 2 days ago is that it is less and less likely that Al Gore is thinking of getting in the race.
Oh, that's interesting.
A month ago, it was obviously he is still toying with it. Yeah. But these are people who are very connected to the Gore people. I mean, very connected. And they're saying to me, it is getting less and less likely. And, of course, with the Bloomberg situation, entering possibly, things have changed the landscape dramatically in 2 days.
Yeah. Mark Green is blogging over at the Huffington Post, the president of Air America and the former political opponent of Mayor Bloomberg. And he suggests that if Bloomberg gets into the race, he'll pull 3 Democratic votes for every 2 Democratic votes that he pulls. That it'll be a third-party candidacy that will hurt the Democratic Party. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thought is of course, at 19% of the vote, Perot got not one electoral vote, but all he has to do in the states that count, in other words,
he being Bloomberg,
Bloomberg is to get 35 or 36% of the vote in any group of states. That may not be that difficult in this kind of climate right now. And particularly, I mean, it depends who the Republicans. If the Republicans pull in a Romney type, I think Bloomberg does extremely well. If they pull in Giuliani, Bloomberg does not do well, and I don't think Bloomberg is going to get in the race if he thinks Giuliani is going to be there. I could be wrong, but that's, again, what some people are. At least people who know a lot more about these predictor things than I do.
Yeah, but most of the betting now, you look at the betting sites over in the UK, where they're betting on the presidential elections, increasingly it looks like Fred Thompson versus Hillary Clinton.
That looks very well for Hillary Clinton, I think.
Yeah.
Unless Bloomberg gets in the race.
See, I think Fred Thompson has all this mojo with the Republicans right now because nobody knows who he is. And he's only been defined by his movie roles. And once people realize that he spent 20 years as a high-priced, Gucci shoe-wearing lobbyist, as a member of the United States Senate, he was one of the most incompetent and pretty much absentee senators of all.
As you may know, I report for 3 Tennessee stations, individual stations, not syndicated, mm-hmm. but literally I'm on with them every day. I've been for years. And they say to me, nobody really knows who Fred Thompson is.
Yeah, and this is his
home
state.
Nobody knew who George Bush was, and look what happened.
Right, and nobody knew who Ronald Reagan. Well, I guess they knew who Ronald Reagan was, but they thought he was just a cowboy and a kind of half-baked governor of California. So
exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting. What else is happening in Washington, D.C.
right now?
Well,
I think the big news is that the Judiciary Committee had a 13-3 vote, and they are going to subpoena Justice Department documents dealing with warrantless surveillance. This is Leahy's committee, and more power to them. They want all kinds of information from how the decision was made to what kind of people were petitioned, et cetera. This is going to get very, very interesting. And my brother Michael Ratner, as you know, the Center for Constitutional Rights, has said part of the reason they don't want this information out is they think they tried to get warrantless information on lawyers.
Oh, wow. See, I think they tried to get it on politicians, which is just as bad. But fascinating. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Always great talking to you. It was wonderful seeing you Monday and Tuesday at the Take Back America Conference. Coming up tomorrow, Bernie Sanders, our Anything Goes Day. Bernie Sanders, Senator. First of all, our first hour, Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls, Brunch with Bernie. And then we'll be taking your calls throughout the rest of the day. And the Tom Hartman radio program, which is fair and slightly unbalanced. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.